Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Peter Gaiman, Professor of Old Testament and Biblical Languages at Shepherd Seminary. This podcast is dedicated to discussing issues related to Scripture and theology. For more information, visit petergaiman.com.
Well, a very happy November to everyone out there, or I suppose if you're listening to this sometime in the future, maybe it's not November, but wherever you are, whenever you're listening to this, I hope you are having a fabulous day or night or wherever you may find yourself. And I would like to introduce the new series that we're going to be looking at over the next couple episodes, and that's going to be on critical race theory. So critical race theory, if you're not familiar with it, is very, very popular in our culture today. You may have seen it in the news when President Trump actually rescinded critical race theory teaching to all governmental agencies. In fact, he forbid the government from doing any kind of enterprise or engagement with any critical race theory teaching. And he was immediately labeled as a racist, not surprisingly, but it definitely brought critical race theory to the fore, and that launched a bunch of articles about, hey, what is critical race theory? And if you just read the media, if you read the New York Times best-selling list, you will see critical race theory all over the place, profitable, a good thing, something to be emulated, applied in our lives because it teaches us to be anti-racist. So that's basically the main takeaway, but you're obviously not surprised when I say that for the Christian, there's more to it than that. And so we need to be especially equipped mentally to think through these things as Christians, because it's not just straightforward. There are worldview implications at play here. And so we need to think about it. So I've had the opportunity over the last couple months to have quite a few interactions on critical race theory, both on an individual level as well as do a few presentations. And so I wanted to also draw from that and kind of put some things together, summarize them on the podcast platform so that others could benefit that from that as well. So that's going to be our plan for the next couple episodes, is do some critical race theory background and worldview analysis and hopefully benefit from that together. Now, by way of introducing this concept, the first thing I would say is, by way of painting the picture of why this is a necessary discussion, is that race relationships, and when I say race relationships, I'm really referring to ethnicities. As Christians, we only believe in one race, humanity, but just for sake of clarity, because everyone else uses the term race, when really they're referring to different ethnicities, we would use that same terminology by way of communication. Usually we understand that. But by way of race relationships, Gallup Polls released a poll earlier this year in 2020, which shows that race relationships is viewed as poor as it's ever been in the last 20 years. So I'm looking at the chart right here on my computer, and in 2020, white adults, 46% of them said that the relationship between whites and blacks is good, somewhat good, or very good. So the 46% of white adults said that. 36% of black adults said that the relationship between whites and blacks is good or somewhat good or very good. So only less than half of both people groups, white adults, black adults, we'll talk about that more in a little bit, they view it as positive, as good. That's the lowest point it's been in years. Now, the poll doesn't go back further than the year 2000. In the year 2000, you had 70% of whites saying the relationship was good and 62% of blacks saying it was good. And then following that, in 2002, you had 70% of whites saying, 70% of blacks in 2000 said that the relationships were very good. 62% of whites said they were very good. And then in 2002, they were about equal, 70 and 68% respectively said that the relationships were good. And that is a very similar line all the way through to about 2013. So through 2000 to 2013, you had very good, or I guess you could say consistent evaluation of the relationship between whites and blacks. And then there was a big nosedive in 2014. Now, this is something that I think is fair to point out, that everyone says that Trump has divided the country and whatever. Well, here's a little tidbit. Trump became president in 2016, right? And it was already before that, 2013, where you started to see the dive in race relations, at least how they were viewed, and what was the contributing factor to that. So do we say that Obama was the reason for that? Well, some people would say that. I don't think that that's actually the problem. Obama, I think, is actually just a symptom of a worldview issue, which was actually in line. And so that brings us up to talking about critical race theory, is that Obama was actually a participant in a critical race theory system. Like he would embrace the ideas that are found in critical race theory. Just the mindset, the worldview that he proposed, the people that he put in charge, he advocated for that. And so we can look at this worldview then and make sense of why there is a decrease in race relationships, why people think things are getting worse. And we can evaluate it objectively, theoretically, understanding the worldview behind these things. So I think that that's going to be an important starting point for us as we go through that. So to put the past with the present, we obviously understand that there is some significant history and negative history at that with regard to the relationships between whites and blacks in the United States. I mean, we're not sugarcoating that or anything like that. But even as the statistics showed, there was a perception that these things had been getting better and better and better. Well, you look at Martin Luther King Jr. Obviously, he is one of the centerpieces of the civil rights movement in the mid-1900s, and he is epitomized as that struggle for equality, and rightly so. We value his contribution. And in one of his most famous speeches, he has given a picture of what he dreams about, right? So I have two quotes I think in particular are helpful. He said in his famous I Have a Dream speech, he said, "I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood." So in other words, hey, doesn't matter whether you're a former slave or a former slave owner, I dream of the fact that we sit down together in equality. He says later on in the speech, "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." Now, that is an amazing quote, and I really think that that hits the essence of what we as human beings would desire, is that we don't want people to be evaluated by the color of their skin, but we would rather have them judged by their character, right? Now, take that idea of the traditional civil rights movement, and now I'm going to fast forward to today. And by the way, that whole concept of civil rights, pushing back against segregation, obviously we saw tremendous progress made. We saw desegregation. We saw all these elements which are helpful in promoting equality. But it's so interesting to look at what's happening today. And you might say, well, what in the world is going on? Because you have, as an example, a email that I have obtained from certain sources that is part of the University of Kentucky's Student Services and the Student Life Council. And this is the email that they sent to their RAs. And I'm just going to read a paragraph here. They say, "Tomorrow we will begin the morning with a presentation from Brandon Colbert from Bias Incident Support Services. He is going to talk about microaggressions and microinvalidations in the workplace and the harm that they cause. This session will lead us into two separate breakout sessions, one for RAs who identify as Black, Indigenous, person of color, and one for RAs who identify as white. You received an invite to both sessions, but you are expected to attend only the one that corresponds best to your identity." So note very clearly what's going on here. You have a return to segregation, right? You know, one for blacks or people of color and one for whites. That is the standard that's held up by University of Kentucky. Now you might say, oh, that's weird. That's an outlier. You know, this isn't normal. Well, One of the things that also has made headlines over the past couple weeks, really over 2020 as a whole, is the city of Seattle. They've been in the news for, having 100 days of riots or whatever, just tremendous unrest in that city. Well, one of the things that's marked about Seattle is that they are known to have held segregated training sessions for their white staff aimed at undoing their whiteness. And also told them, quote, not to take undeserved promotions, end quote, to be better allies for racial justice. That, I'm looking at an article that I have preserved here from, the Daily Mail Online, which is a UK news service. You also have it reported by other news sources as well, but that was one of the just first ones that popped up when I Googled, that subject. So you have certain cities, Seattle, one of them, but not the only one that has segregated, work studies, work training sessions. You also have, and I'm looking at an article from August now. So not too long ago, August 24th. And this comes from the Fox News, service. It says New York University student group demands black only student housing on campus. And so the quote by the student group says that NYU is a predominantly white institution, making it very difficult for black students to connect, end quote. Now, I will say to the credit of NYU, they say that that's not going to happen. They're not going to give blacks their own housing on campus. But what I think is so interesting is that if you look at what's going on here, this student group thinks that they are fighting racism by demanding a return to segregated housing. It's very interesting, kind of the full circle that has happened here. There's also been reports coming out of California where there's been similar demands that have been made. The question is, why in the world or how could this generation or certain groups within this generation, because it's not everybody, but there is at least a very significant push to see a racially segregated or racialized society. And so you go from the cry of the civil rights movement originally, as voiced by Martin Luther King Jr., where he says it's not the color of the skin, but the content of the character. Whereas now today, and this movement is being painted as the continuation of the civil rights, except it's pushing in the opposite direction. You are seeing the emphasis of the color of the skin instead of the content of the character. And so if you're just a observer of these phenomenon here, you have to ask, how in the world did we get here? What in the world is happening? This seems so antithetical to an objective. And by the way, I would say this, we're going to get into some of these details. Clearly, this is an important aspect of this. But I would say that a lot of people don't understand. They kind of see the incongruence, but then they are told that this is what you need to do in order to not be racist. And nobody wants to be racist. So if somebody tells you need to support, this idea of affirming blacks because they're black or whatever, then you need to do that. Otherwise, you're racist. And so this is a big push. It's a peer pressure at its simplistic form by society. And so you have a bunch of people who are unwilling to kind of question things. And so they follow along. So now we need to think about this on a deeper level, clearly. And obviously this is why it's going to take a couple episodes in going through this, because there's a lot that's involved here. And I would say there's at least three main elements that we need to understand in order to understand the idea of culture and why critical race theory has embedded itself so deeply. So the three-pronged approach, the crossroads, I would say would be Marxism. You need to understand the history of Marxism. You need to understand, second of all, critical theory, which is related to Marxism, but not identical with critical theory. And I would say with that, that's also the idea of social justice. You hear justice and social justice talked about a lot, but we need to understand the history of what in the world is being talked about with social justice. So Marxism, we need to know that. We need to know critical theory and social justice, number two. And then number three, we also need to know the connection of postmodernism and how that relates to this discussion as well. So I would say those three elements. If we can put our fingers on those and wrap our minds around them a little bit, then we really have a guide, an understanding of why people are looking at the world the way that they are, why they do the things that they do. We can understand cancel culture. We can understand what racism is in their worldview. And more importantly, then we can deconstruct that from a biblical worldview, saying, hey, this is where this does not coincide with what truth actually is as represented by God's revelation. And we can call people to task for that. So it's important that we understand that. So let's talk a little bit about Marxism. This is something that is important, obviously, as a foundational reality, and it all begins with an individual by the name of Karl Marx. The individual who this viewpoint is associated with, his name, Marx. He was born to a Christian family, a nominal Christian family, a Lutheran liberal denomination. His family had formerly been Jewish. I think it was his grandfather who was a rabbi. And so Marx was raised in a Christian environment, but he converted to atheism very early in life, which wasn't obviously a very large departure from liberal Christianity. So he made atheism his religion. He centered everything that he did around that concept. In fact, atheism and the lack of God became central to everything that he stood for, and a lot of his theories revolve around this concept that man is inherently good, sin is non-existent with regard to original sin and total depravity of man. Those concepts are gone in the worldview of Marx, and so you have to consider that when you're thinking through some of his doctrines. Now, when you look through Marx's biography, one of the most important steps in his life was he went to study at Berlin University, and there he focused on the philosophy of Hegel. And Hegel's most famous for what's known as the dialectical process, where you have the formulation of ideas, which come in the form of a thesis, and then that thesis is challenged by the antithesis. And then as those are resolved and worked through together in the mind, you come up with the synthesis. So you have the thesis, the antithesis, and then formed together, you have the synthesis. And so that was Hegel's famous contribution, his dialectic. And Marx took that viewpoint as being important to knowledge and understanding and implementing. And he ended up applying that in an inverted process. But that was instrumental in his ideas. Now, interestingly enough, one of the things I like to point out about Karl Marx is, well, obviously there's a lot more we could say about him, but one of the interesting things is his ideas have been tried quite extensively and failed in many ways. And for a long time, Christians and non-Christians alike viewed him as very dangerous. However, in 1999, Marx ended up being voted the thinker of the millennium, like most influential, like best thinker of the millennium in 1999 by a UK poll. And in fact, he beat out a little known individual by the name of Albert Einstein. So according to this generation, Marx was a more influential thinker than Albert Einstein, which is rather interesting as it might seem. So what came from Marx? What was a big part of his system? Well, Marx developed what became known as classical Marxism, and that was the viewpoint that there is a problem in humanity, and that problem is oppression. So oppression is the fundamental problem of humanity, and it's built into what became known as the class system. Now, the class system, according to Marx, revolved primarily around the capitalist class, and in the writings and in his descriptions, this capitalist class is known as the bourgeoisie, and they oppressed the working class, which is known as the proletariat. You've heard those two terms before. The bourgeoisie is the capitalist class. The working class is the proletariat. And the capitalists would oppress the working class citizens in order to make profits for themselves. So there's this class dynamic of oppression. It's economic. And Marx taught that revolution would naturally come because the workers saw that they were being oppressed and that this was not fair. And so the class system would eventually dissolve itself, and the family would also be dissolved because the family was also a part of that useless class system. And so Marx said, well, hey, this is just a natural consequence. People are going to be enlightened. They're going to recognize that they themselves are oppressed. And so you're going to have this dissolution of this class system. And so he actually taught, that is, Marx did, that the most capitalistic nations would be the first to rise up in rebellion. So you had London, with Great Britain, you had America, you had France. He prophesied, if you will, that these most capitalistic nations would be the first to rebel and embrace Marxism because they were the ones that had these class differentiations. But it didn't actually work out that way. In fact, you saw that Marxism ended up being implemented by some of the lesser developed countries. You had Russia, China, Cambodia, Cuba, Burma, Congo, Zimbabwe, East Germany, North Korea. Venezuela ended up trying out his ideas, and they went from being the most prosperous nation in South America to being one of the least prosperous nations now. Tremendous illustration there. And so we see some very problematic ideas about those, or results with those nations that have tried Marxism. In fact, Marxist ideology is really identified with and responsible for 100 million deaths in the last century. Historians have noted that. And so it's really more than any other ideology can be attributed to. And so just thinking about the results, the pragmatic results of Marxism and applying that, there are some very difficult things to overcome from the ideology. And by the way, we've talked about this with regard to socialism and things like that. Obviously, Marxism has to be socialist. And one of the problems of socialism inherently is that it has to be accomplished through violence. So Marxism and socialism, the inherent socialism that's involved with that, relies on the power of the government, of the sword, in order to compel people by force to do what they don't want to do, because you can't have rogue people doing whatever they want. And so that's one of the reasons why this ideology is so dangerous and failed so dramatically. So and I should say this too as well, when you evaluate Marxism, one of the main problems theoretically with Marxism is that Marx's philosophy views economic policy as a zero-sum game. So in other words, Marx thought when someone wins, everyone else loses. So you can't have multiple winners. So you can only have one winner. It's kind of visualized by the pie. You have one pie of one size, and that pie isn't going to change. So when somebody gets, say, half the pie, that only leaves half of the pie left over for everybody else. So zero sum game. And that's not how economics works. You know, everyone acknowledges that, just because somebody makes a dollar doesn't mean that somebody else can't make a dollar or less than a dollar or whatever. It's not a zero-sum game. And so that's where Marxism ultimately failed. And people saw that. People saw that in the capitalist nations, you had the elites, if you want to say it that way, the people who made a lot of money. But while they rose to prominence, there was the rise of the middle class. And that was what kept Marxism from taking hold, is that people liked being rich. I mean, sure, they weren't the richest, but they also weren't poor anymore. And the middle class ended up being a lot better off than even some of the rich in some of these lesser developed countries. And so you have, let's say you have some disincentive to the rebellion that Marxism promised. So you do have the lingering question among some of the adherents of this viewpoint of Marxism, though, is why didn't Marxist ideas work? Now, I kind of already gave you some of the reasons why I think it didn't work, but that didn't stop philosophers from philosophizing. And so one of the most well-known individuals you have in the late 1800s into the early 1900s is Antonio Gramsci, who was an Italian, and he was born in 1891. And in 1913, he ended up joining the Italian Socialist Party. And he worked closely with somebody you've probably heard of before, Benito Mussolini. And although working with him originally because of his threat of being an intellect and his involvement with that, you had Mussolini actually imprisoning Gramsci. And while he was sent to the prison island from 1926 to 1934, he ended up writing what became known as the prison notebooks. And the prison notebooks were very influential on the scene with regard to socialism and arguing for Marxism. They weren't published until 1948, but when they were published, they made their way into English. They became very influential in the United States. This is what ended up being the next step in the Marxist playbook. And these are the main differences, or the advances, the progress from Marxism to what became known as neo-Marxism. Gramsci believed that the reason that there was no revolution, which is what Marx had prophesied, was that, you know, there's going to be a revolution among these capitalist societies because of the oppression that people view between the different class systems. Well, the reason that Gramsci said that never happened was because the Western culture was blocking this uprising. So for Gramsci, the Western culture was linked with Christianity, and that cultural hegemony, which was a part of Christianity and Western culture, it pushed down any possibility of rebellion. So on the one hand, Marx was saying that economics was the pathway to culture. And so when people recognized the problem that was involved with the economics, you would have the rebellion that took place. But Gramsci was saying, no, Marx had it wrong. He actually had it reversed. The culture is what leads to economics, and the culture is what suppresses people, and it deceives people and whatnot. So you ultimately had Gramsci teaching then that for Marxism to be successful, there needed to be a de-Christianization in the Western culture, and the culture needed to be changed through a slow and steady infiltration and teaching. Now, this became known as what's now referred to as neo-Marxism, because it's changed, right? We recognize that this is a different strategy. It's a different idea. Instead of seeing the culture being changed through the intense revolution, which was promised, now you have the need that is seen by the neo-Marxist to change the culture first so that you can have the class systems leveled and changed and destroyed. Now, just in case you're saying like, okay, well, I don't know if I believe that. Well, here's one of Gramsci's quotes that I think is, you know, kind of just self-evident of what his strategy is. He says, in the new order, socialism will triumph by first capturing the culture via infiltration of the schools, universities, churches, and the media by transforming the consciousness of society, end quote. So in other words, this is his strategy for implementing socialism. The way we need to do this is we need to put our people in the schools, put our people in the universities, in the churches, in the media, and then we transform the way society thinks, we transform culture, we kill Christianity, and we are able to then change these things. Now you might say, well, you know, that sounds a little violent, you know. Are we sure that they hated Christianity? You know, maybe they were just being sensitive. Well, here's another quote by Gramsci. He says this, quote, socialism is precisely the religion that must kill Christianity. It is a religion in the sense that it too is a faith, and because it has substituted for the consciousness of the transcendental God of the Catholics, trust in man and his best strengths as the sole spiritual reality, end quote. Let me say that first part again. Socialism is precisely the religion that must kill Christianity. Okay, it's funny because you talk about, and there are people, for example, in the United States, in well-known organizations like Black Lives Matter, and they say themselves, we are trained Marxists. And you say, oh, I wonder what a Marxist is. A Marxist is one who wants to kill Christianity. It's one who wants to elevate social. I mean, this isn't hard to figure out, right? This is not, if you know enough to call yourself a Marxist, you know what you're doing. Okay. I mean, it's the people who don't know that they're the ignorant Marxists that you have to watch out for, because they just buy into the system without thinking much about it. But notice what Gramsci's talking about here is he's saying the reason socialism is a religion is because you have a trust in man and his best strengths. So in other words, we put our faith in man as socialists. Well, that's why socialism can never succeed, right? We've talked about that. I've written some blog articles about that. The depravity of man is a central focus in scripture, talking about the sinfulness of man. The heart is wicked. You know, this is the source of quarrels and conflicts and everything wrong. It comes from within man. And so any system which puts its trust in man is doomed from the outset. And we need to understand that. Now, that's in and of itself a very important foundational starting point. But there's also something that coincides with this viewpoint and with this Marxist reach that revolves around what's known as the Frankfurt School in Germany. And so we need to know a little bit about that as well in order to kind of conceptualize where what we're seeing in the United States actually comes to bear. Because so far we've talked about Marx, we've talked about Gramsci, but how does that relate to the United States? How does that relate to what we're seeing in our present culture? Well, a lot of that relates to the Frankfurt School, because the Frankfurt School conceptually began in 1923. So that was a long time ago, right? Almost 100 years ago. And it was originally going to be called the Institute for Marxism, right? But because of political pressure, obviously Marxism had some negative views to it even at that time. So they ended up calling themselves the Institute for Social Research. Let that be a lesson to you. It's all advertising, and just because something is named something doesn't mean that's what it is. So this is an institute that's all about Marxism, essentially, but they're named the Institute for Social Research. Now, the leader, Max Horkheimer, he was very influential in the Frankfurt School. In fact, he ended up having some very influential ideas behind the critical theory, which we'll talk about in just a moment. But the Frankfurt School followed Gramsci and adopted the neo-Marxist approach. And so all that we just talked about with regard to the philosophy of why revolution didn't take place, the need to change culture, all of those ideas were imbibed by the Frankfurt School. And in 1933, following the Nazi rise to power, the Frankfurt School fled. So even though that's where the original leadership and headship of the school was, they ended up leaving to Geneva initially. And then actually a few of the prominent individuals of the Frankfurt School made their way to the United States. So that's where we see the cross-pollination between these ideas and how they make their way to the United States, is that you have influential individuals getting places in academia, in Brandeis University, you have Berkeley University. These universities are having these tenured professors now from Germany come and teach these ideas. And slowly and surely, these ideas start to take hold, and they actually coincide very nicely with the sexual revolution in the 1960s, which is another idea and another discussion. But those things are not unrelated. You know, there's so much that's interrelated in life, and this is something that's we see and how the connection is brought over to the United States. We imported this in the era of World War II. Now, the Frankfurt School, the most popular connection is known in critical theory. And so Marxism and critical theory are related. Now, remember what I said is you need to know Marxism, you need to know critical theory, and you need to know postmodernism in order to understand what's going on in today's racial relationships. And so critical theory is connected to Marxism, but it's not inherent to it. In other words, Marxists weren't the only ones who were discussing this, but it becomes essential to Marxism as a way of constructing, or I should say deconstructing, society. So what is a critical theory? So a critical theory, when we think of critical, we think of something like evaluation We think of theory as in a hypothesis, but that's not the idea here. A critical theory is a social critique attempting to undermine the status quo in hope of changing it for the better. So in other words, it's distinct from a traditional theory in it doesn't just explain society, it also changes. It must change society. So that's when we say a critical theory, we're talking about something that inherently is defined as a changing tool. So for example, I mentioned Max Horkheimer, and he defined critical theory as one that must be explanatory, it must be practical, and it must be normative in order for it to be a critical theory. So all three of those must be evident at the same time. So explanatory, practical, and normative. What does that mean? That means it must explain what's wrong with current social reality. So that's explanatory. Then it also must identify the actors to change it. In other words, it must be practical. It must have a practical application, like how do we change this? Who do we put into place to change these things? And then thirdly, it's also normative, meaning it must provide both clear norms for criticism and also achievable practical goals for societal transformation. So in other words, you're looking in order for a critical theory to work, it needs to be setting a standard to shoot for, to change for, and provide the means by which that can be accomplished. So that's what a critical theory is. It's at its core, it's very subversive, trying to upend the status quo or what's viewed as normal. Now, critical theory as a whole applies to more than just critical race theory. It does apply to race studies, but you maybe have heard of queer theory, post-colonial theory, gender theory. These are all aspects that apply critical theory to a variety of paradigms. For example, gender theory is trying to upend the status quo of the so-called patriarchal society, the male dominant culture, and so they're trying to achieve that kind of success in their viewpoint. You have queer theory, which is what they would say is battling the cisgender priority and things like that. Post-colonial theory, similar. So feminism, these are all aspects that or branches which apply critical theory in, and there's lots of them. I just gave you a few of them, but this is an important thing to understand, is that critical theory is applied by many activist groups now in a variety of forms. LGBT is obviously huge. They've done a lot with this, but for our purposes, we're talking about this from the element of critical race theory and how critical theory is applied there. So remember, critical theory is related to the Frankfurt School. They're the ones who popularized it. They applied it specifically in a variety of places and imported it to the United States, where it becomes heavily involved with critical race theory, which we'll talk about more next time in the future. But that's a very essential aspect of understanding how these things do together. Yes, Marxism at its core, neo-Marxism, has as a goal to change society. And the tool which Marxism wants to use is called critical theory. And so that's the deconstruction of looking at what it is culture is designed to do, subverting that process, trying to change that through a variety of means. So as we kind of summarize this, we have Karl Marx theorizing that there would be the natural revolution brought about by the oppression in society, which ultimately leads to a utopian state. Because remember, as an atheist, that's really important here to remember, Marx believed that if everybody was equal, there would be no reason to have discontentment, because mankind is, you know, nice. They're good inherently, right? So if mankind is good inherently, then the natural revolution would bring about a eschatological utopia and paradise, because everyone would be equal and they would all rejoice in that. Well, that never happened, right? So Gramsci then, and others with the Frankfurt School and whatnot, they shifted to what we refer to now as neo-Marxism. And neo-Marxism put the emphasis on the need to systematically dismantle Western culture. Western culture was viewed as the problem. And so Western culture needs to go. And in order to remove that, we need to put our people in the institutions, in the churches, in the media. We need to change public consciousness and tell them that Western society is evil. We need to tell them that Western culture is bad, that it's systematically problematic in many ways. And so we need to advocate for tearing it down, starting over. That's kind of the big push in neo-Marxism. Now, to kind of summarize that, there's one of the prominent individuals who was known in his activism for neo-Marxism was Rudy Deutschke, who was an adherent of Gramsci and neo-Marxism. And he has a famous quote, which you've probably heard before, but I think it's important to throw it in here. Rudy Deutschke called this strategy the, quote, long march through the institutions, end quote. The long march through the institutions. And what he meant by that is that this is a long-term strategy. We need to start by putting our people in the institutions, the schools, the universities, and that's how we're going to win the culture war. Now, we're gonna stop here, but I just want to put this in perspective. Already, I hope you begin to see that. Well, let's just put it bluntly. People were saying that Trump was the problem, that he was causing so much division among the people. And let's just put it bluntly. Trump wasn't the problem. He came too late. Trump was really just showing us very clearly what the problem was. There was actually a problem much further back, where the prominent education institutions from elementary school all the way through universities are really Marxist at adherence. And they're, you know, and they don't even shy away from calling themselves Marxists. And they're teaching these ideas. They're saying, hey, Western culture is the problem. Western culture, these societies are wrong. They're systematically racist. They are systematically gender oppressive. They are systematically, oppressive to non-cisgender, homosexuals, LGBT issues. Like these are the messages that everyone is being taught. And they're being taught that we need to get rid of this culture, that this culture is inherently, like think about the famous example, the 1619 Project, I think it's called, where basically the whole point is saying like America was founded on racism and, you know, everything about America is racist. Well, these are obviously Marxist, neo-Marxist ideas. And the whole point is to deconstruct society. It's to destroy. There is no positive element of that. The ultimate end game is to allow for a utopia, but that doesn't actually exist in neo-Marxism or in the critical theory world, because there always needs to be a deconstruction. That's all that critical theory can do. And as we'll go on and talk about in our discussion about postmodernism next episode, is that when you have somebody who is constantly utilizing critical theory and this deconstructive ideology, that can never stop. There can never be a stop, because once you stop, then you've shown yourself to be a part of the system, which is oppressive. And I think that that's really kind of self-contaminating. There's no way out of that. And there's no winner once you've embraced the system. And so if this continues, we are going to see tremendous, tremendous problems. Both in society, but as a church, if the church embraces any of these ideas, which we're beginning to see, the social justice movement, whatever, all of these are children of these problems, of these viewpoints, of this worldview. And so we want to warn ourselves. We want to be mentally equipped. We want to warn the church. This is a problem, and we need to be beacons of truth, talking about the problems of this. So hopefully this will get us started. I hope it's helpful. We have a lot more to talk about, but this is the starting point, and Lord willing, we'll be able to continue on from here. But I'm happy to hear from you. If you want to, you know, give me your feedback and any questions or comments you might have, you can reach out to me through the contact form on my website. If you also want information on the shepherds.edu website, you can go there and look at the seminary. You can also find a link to the most recent Shepherds 360 conference, and the media from that conference should be available on there any day now. And I look forward to joining you to continue this series. Until next time, may the Lord bless you and keep you, and make his face shine upon you.